Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Thank you for joining us. It's the Friday edition of Balance of Power. Boy, we've had a week around here. But you've made it to the threshold of the weekend, and we've got some smart folks to talk to you about a number of stories that have developed over the course of this day already, beginning with, of course, the manhunt in the shooting death of Charlie Kirk. It has concluded with the arrest of a young man from Utah named Tyler Robinson, and we're learning more about how he was apprehended, how authorities found him, and the work that is left here, not only in chasing leads, but also in building a legal case. We heard from a news briefing this morning a little bit more about this gentleman. Kash Patel, the FBI director, spoke alongside the governor of Utah, Spencer Cox. Let's listen to what he said.
Investigators interviewed a family member of Robinson who stated that Robinson had become more political in recent years. The family member referenced a recent incident in which Robinson came to dinner prior to September 10th, and in the conversation with another family member, Robinson mentioned Charlie Kirk was coming to UVU. They talked about why they didn't like him and the viewpoints that he had. The family member also stated Kirk was full of hate and spreading hate.
Full of hate and spreading hate. Miles Miller has been on this story for several days now, Bloomberg's national security reporter, and joins us live with the latest on this from World Headquarters in New York. Miles, we now have a better sense of the charges this young man will be facing as well.
Right, and AP is reporting that he was arrested on suspicion of capital murder and weapons offenses. Those charges have not been confirmed yet. There are no charging documents yet. I think as we spoke about last hour, what happens in Utah is that there's about 3-day period where they can draw up these charges, and you can bet they're going to take all the time they need to figure out what the charges should be and to figure out how they're going to square this case out when it goes to court.
This young man was arrested after a family member alerted authorities. He was basically turned in by his own family here, Miles. If that hadn't happened, would this manhunt still be on?
Yeah, but it's clear that investigators were getting closer to him. For starters, investigators had identified a gray Dodge Challenger that was leaving the scene after the incident. They figured out that that was his car once they figured out who he was. But if they had gone down that path, what they would have done is run the license plate, figure out who it belonged to, and then start doing questioning. So that would mean that we would have an identification much later on. But, you know, just to talk to you about the timeline of how this all happened, 9 o'clock in Utah is the time, or 9 o'clock Eastern time, Wall Street time, was the time they had the press conference yesterday, about 9:30. It was about 11 o'clock when the suspect gets to his father's house. His father says to him, "Are you that guy in the photo? You look a lot like that guy in the photo." And he admits to carrying out the shooting, then says he wants to kill himself. His father says, "No, let's call the youth pastor." And the youth pastor just happens to be on the task force that's looking for him, calls in a deputy, calls in the FBI, and brings him into justice 33 hours after the shooting.
That is remarkable, Miles. You also mentioned the fact that they pulled out 11,000 leads, generated 11,000 leads in 2 days. Just because this arrest has happened doesn't mean they won't be chasing them all down. What will happen in the days ahead?
Because this is a suspect that was perennially online, you can tell it from the things he wrote on these cartridges that he put into the gun, from what he said in Discord, according to authorities, that this was a person who spent his time online. So they'll be seeing, did he get any material support, right? Did he get any support to carry out this shooting? Whose gun was it? Will a friend from high school say, you know, he was planning to do other things? Will a friend from the neighborhood say he saw him on that day wearing that outfit? All of it is key to figuring out who this guy is and why he planned it. And they're going to leave no stone unturned to be able to have a really robust criminal complaint against him, because these cases are only as good as what you can present to the grand jury.
Got it. Miles, I'm curious if we know, did Dad know the pastor was on the task force?
I'm not sure about that, but, you know, call the youth pastor because they, you know, were members of this church. And I mean, it's just serendipitous that this youth pastor happens to also be a task force officer. You know, the thing in sort of reporting out this story and to bring our viewers and our readers and our listeners into it, Trump makes this announcement at 8 o'clock that they've got a suspect in custody. The press conference gets moved back 30 minutes. I call a source in the marshals, and I said, hey, can you tell us a little bit more about what happened with the arrest? And, you know, the marshal remarked that, of course, like, Trump was telling the story, but, of course, it's always just a little bit different than what actually happened. Let me give you more details. And then they filled it in at the press conference. But, you know, just a little bit about how the sausage is made to get this narrative of what happened and really what was a chase to figure out who this person was, because law enforcement was worried that because they hadn't found this person that he could leave the country, and luckily he was still in Utah, just 3 hours away.
Really fascinating. And great work, Miles. Thank you for lifting the veil on the way this story came together. Bloomberg's national security reporter, Miles Miller. You'll be hearing and seeing a lot more from Miles as we learn more in this case. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. Thank you for being with us here on the Friday edition of Balance of Power. We're balancing news on a number of fronts here today, beyond the Charlie Kirk story and beyond what's happening on Capitol Hill, though there may be a connection there with Congress. We've got our eyes on what's happening in Ukraine and this announcement today by Russia that negotiations with Ukraine are on, quote, pause. Maybe that's partly why President Trump says he's losing patience with Vladimir Putin, even though weeks and multiple deadlines have passed since he indicated that secondary sanctions would be implemented here, knowing that Alaska summit several weeks ago generated nothing. And there are no plans at the moment for Vladimir Putin to meet with Volodymyr Zelensky. Let's go back to that interview that generated a lot of news this morning, including this announcement by the president that someone had been arrested. He was on the couch on Fox and Friends, and the matter of Russia and Ukraine came up. Let's listen.
So has your patience run out with Putin?
Yeah, it's sort of running out and running out fast, but it does take two to tango. It's amazing. When Putin wants to do it, Zelensky didn't. When Zelensky wanted to do it, Putin did. Now Zelensky wants to, and Putin is a question mark. But we're going to have to come down very, very strong.
We'll be hitting very hard on with sanctions to banks and having to do with oil and tariffs also.
But there hasn't been any hitting, never mind hitting hard. And that's where we start our conversation with Mara Rudman, professor at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, former U.S. diplomat with us live in our studio in Washington. Mara, it's great to have you back.
Thanks
for joining us. I have so many questions about this, but I want to start with the actual news from Russia. This pause on negotiations means what? Are we done here?
So I don't mean to smile at this, but, and I certainly mean no disrespect to calling it news. But the fact that there's a pause on negotiations is not a news flash.
Okay.
I mean, right, there's nothing to pause. And in fact, what Russia has been doing steadily before the meeting in Alaska and since has been to be increasingly provocative, including with the drone strikes earlier this week in Poland. And so I find President Trump's comments a little perplexing, probably more than a little perplexing in that regard.
Well, how about the equivalency there? It's like, well, it takes two to tango. One day he doesn't want to talk. The next day this guy doesn't want to talk when, of course, Russia invaded Ukraine.
Precisely. This is not a both-and situation at all. And U.S. national security interests are at stake. Mm-hmm. And I noted how much President Trump uses the present tense, I am running, out of patience. We're well beyond that point, and the rest of the world takes note.
Yeah.
And a friend and colleague recently wrote a column, I think a very thoughtful essay in the Dispatch, Eric Edelman.
Yeah.
And the title of that, quoting former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, was Weakness is Provocative.
Wow.
And I think President Trump is sending a signal of weakness, which is very dangerous for the United States and the world.
Well, you remember Barack Obama's red line in Syria. That's something that Donald Trump talked about a lot. This has been going on. There were multiple red lines when it came to Russia. It's been going on for actually months, not weeks. Does it feel to you like the drumbeat on sanctions is getting louder?
I think the challenge we have is the distance between the statements President Trump makes and the action that follows. And the rest of the world watches and calculates. And so I think that we have in President Putin somebody who thinks he's got a red carpet to do what he wants, where he wants.
Saw that carpet in Anchorage.
Precisely.
Let's talk about what happened in Poland, because you would think that this event would be the very thing to trigger, if anything, secondary sanctions. We have an Article 4 incursion. The president was asked about it in that same interview today. And he said, hold on, this may have been a mistake, which is something he said yesterday. And we've heard from Poland on this, as a matter of fact. Donald Tusk himself, the prime minister of Poland on Twitter, we would also wish the drone attack on Poland was a mistake, but it wasn't, and we know it. That's the statement. What does Poland think of this rhetoric?
Well, Poland's been very clear, and I'm sure they're also very concerned. And they're not alone. Others in Europe, this is perhaps one of the few things that Russia's actions in Ukraine and towards Poland that actually unites Europe and European leaders. So we saw the Italian defense minister making strong statements similar to that of Polish leaders. Yeah. And the NATO, Mark Rutte, the NATO, the lead for NATO,
Secretary General,
thank you, I believe also made some strong statements. So President Trump isolates himself in the United States when he talks in terms like this is an error, a mistake, and not a deliberate attempt by Putin to do what he's doing.
Do you have any hope for any result to come from an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on this? They're doing that today.
Well, I'll say on another issue, it was interesting, the emergency meeting earlier this week, lost track of days, on Qatar, where the United States joined a unanimous resolution there. So there may be room yet for the Security Council to show some action. Of course, on this issue, it's much more difficult because Russia and China are not going to be in the same place as the United States.
Here we
at
go
all.
Again. That's right. What was the motivation behind this incursion in Poland? We have an Article 4 that's been triggered here. Is Vladimir Putin trying to find the line on Article 5?
I think that what Putin is doing is consistently testing how far he can go without getting a response or reaction.
He hasn't gotten one yet.
From the United States.
Well, that's right.
He certainly has from NATO and from Europe. But he's focused in on whether President Trump in the United States is going to do anything. There are some actions the United States can take. You mentioned sanctions against the major Russian energy companies, agreeing to Europe's price on oil, putting a cap at $48 a barrel as opposed to the $60 a barrel. Making sure, going forward with unfreezing Russian assets, seizing the frozen Russian assets of about $300 billion and making them available to the Ukrainians. There are tangible moves out there that could be made that the United States could signal in real time. And that's the kind of response I think that Putin needs to see to step back.
Well, it's interesting because we've been talking about this for years. And in the Biden administration, the question we kept asking on the air was, what is there left to sanction? Because the message from the administration was, we have turned the screws in a way that no one ever has in history. How come Joe Biden didn't do all of this?
So Joe Biden did do some of
this. When it comes to secondary sanctions.
Well, I think that some of the things that are being discussed...
I know they cut off the banking system. The Biden administration did a lot. Think that there was much more to do is surprising to a lot of people.
So I can't give you the specifics right now, but I am fair, because I don't want to misstate.
Sure.
But I am fairly sure that the discussion, for example, on seizing frozen assets and using them was very much on the list in the near-term list, and I think you probably would have seen that if there was a second Biden administration.
Okay.
I think the nature of the sanctions on the Russian energy companies was done to some degree, but could be strengthened as well. So that's why I point to some of those steps.
I just wonder if there was a strategy there in holding back some of this stuff so you still had arrows in the quiver.
Fair point.
Yeah.
I think it was calibrated. I think there was a lot of tension and pushing probably within the Biden administration about when to do more and how. There certainly was on what kind of equipment to give to Ukraine and to make accessible
for sure.
to them.
Yes. You mentioned Qatar. President's dealing with a couple of hot issues right now. This is just not only Ukraine and not only Gaza. When Vladimir Putin is sending drones into Poland and Benjamin Netanyahu is sending missiles into Doha, the temperature's rising inside this administration when it comes to geopolitics.
I think, yes. And as you said at the beginning of the broadcast, it's been quite a week.
That's,
I mean, it's hard to imagine all the stuff has happened this week.
Do you believe that the president does have the assurance of Benjamin Netanyahu that that will not happen again? The negotiators were in town when those missiles landed.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of any assurances, though frankly I'm skeptical of assurances the president gives to others as well as the assurances he receives. Because I think my biggest concern is he is seen as a weak leader.
Boy.
And other leaders around the world are calibrating against that.
Yet he projects himself as a strong man.
Yeah, I'm remembering the phrase about walk softly, but
yeah, sure.
Step softly but carry a big stick.
Mm-hmm.
I think he does just the opposite, and I think that's dangerous.
Well, these two have yet to resolve, and we'd love to stay in touch with you on all of this, Mara. Thank you so much for coming in. Mara Rudman
Thank
with
you.
Us once again, bringing her expertise and insights to the program. We're going to assemble our political panel next. We've got a good one today. Jeannie Shanzano and Lisa Camuso-Miller are with us today on Balance of Power with much more to talk about here involving the shooting death of Charlie Kirk. An arrest has been made. The Associated Press is talking about charges. We got the update just now from Miles Miller, and we're going to talk more about the political implications here with some very hot rhetoric. And the President of the United States suggesting it's time to beat, as he used the term, to beat down the radical left. We'll get into this with our Republican and Democrat, both on the panel straight ahead on Balance of Power on Bloomberg TV and radio. Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We talk politics here in Washington. And if you've been with us for the past couple of days, well, it's been a very difficult conversation in a political world that was left in tatters by the killing of Charlie Kirk. This story has developed rapidly over the course of this day, starting with President Trump on Fox and Friends announcing that an arrest had been made. He didn't identify the individual, but he did say that the manhunt had ended. That, of course, was followed by an FBI news conference that included the governor of Utah. But the president was asked about some of the rhetoric around all of this, the political extremism, remembering that he said in the White House driveway yesterday as he was on his way to New York, just before he stepped on the lawn to get on Marine One, the president said, "We have a great country. We have radical left lunatics out there, and we just have to beat the hell out of them." Now, to be fair, the president also said in a separate conversation that Kirk was an advocate of nonviolence. That's the way I'd like to see people respond. But the headline of beat the hell out of them is making the rounds around here. And the president doubled down on that a bit, at least when it comes to the blame game this morning on Fox and Friends. He was asked about extremism on both sides of the political spectrum. Here was his response.
The radicals on the right oftentimes are radical because they don't want to see crime. They don't want to see crime.
Worried about the border.
They're saying, we don't want these people coming in. We don't want you burning our shopping centers. We don't want you shooting our people in the middle of the street. The radicals on the left are the problem. And they're vicious and they're horrible and they're politically savvy.
That's where we start with our political panel. Bloomberg Politics contributor Jeannie Shanzano, Democracy Visiting Fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Ash Center. Joined today by Republican strategist Lisa Camuso-Miller, the former RNC communications director and host of the Friday Reporter podcast. It's great to have both of you with us here, knowing that this is a pretty difficult topic. Lisa, do you see it the way President Trump does, that in fact radicals on one side are more dangerous than the other?
Joe, I think that the language of blame is what's corroding this country. And that's really fundamentally how I feel. I think that this othering, this pointing of fingers, it's rooted in fear. And it's not It's not, it's inextricably linked with 9/11, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it is the fear that was brought on from the fear of terrorism and the fear of our country being under threat that has stoked all of the division. And I'm not the only person that said this. There's plenty of other people smarter than me that have done the analysis. But now we come to a time when we have had this tremendous loss. And I think it sets a precedent for what comes next. I mean, there, yes, gun violence in this country is absolutely abhorrent at every single level. I think the reason why people are so caught off guard by this particular incident, though, is that this is not someone that was an elected official. This is not someone that had a public forum. He did, I mean, but he was not an elected official. So the fact that we are stoking one versus the othering, this guy's to blame or that guy is to blame, it's that shred of empathy that has been lost in the country that will continue to corrode all of us.
Well, quite a contrast between the language that we just heard and have been hearing from President Trump and another Republican by the name of Spencer Cox. That's the governor of Utah. You've seen him on this program a couple of times. Jeannie, he's been very deliberate in his wording, not just this morning, but yesterday as well. I want you to listen to what he said about some of the disinformation and the blame game that surrounded this. It started within moments of the news of Charlie Kirk's death. Listen to Governor Cox.
It is also much bigger than an attack on an individual. It is an attack on all of us. It is an attack on the American experiment. It is an attack on our ideals. This cuts to the very foundation of who we are. We will never be able to solve all the other problems, including the violence problems that people are worried about, if we can't have a clash of ideas safely and securely. Even, especially those ideas with which you disagree.
He went on to say a lot more about the disinformation that they are tracking. He said that his team on the state and federal level as well are seeing that our adversaries, he said, want violence. We have bots from Russia, China, all over the world trying to instill disinformation and encourage violence. He said, I would encourage you to ignore those. Jeannie, I think you would agree with the comments from Spencer Cox. How worried are you about the rhetoric from the president?
Yeah, I'm so glad you played Governor Cox's comments. To your point, immediately after this horrific killing, today when he spoke at a very emotional press conference, his remarks are the definition of leadership. And unfortunately, the president's are not. The president is doing what so many people are doing, unfortunately, online, which is in the midst of this horrific incident, they are leaping forward to blame the other side and to do the exact thing that President Trump said happened to Charlie Kirk, the dehumanization. He turns around and does the exact same thing sitting on that couch at Fox today. You know, the reality is that President Trump is the leader of this country. Leadership matters. He should take a lesson from Governor Cox. He should also, quite frankly, take a lesson from Charlie Kirk. Whether you like Charlie Kirk or not, he was a provocateur. I think 99% of what he said, I would probably disagree with. But he was open to collegial debate amongst people, particularly those people he disagreed with. What did he say? The title of this tour was Prove Me Wrong. And college students could go up there and try to prove him wrong. Was it a showman thing? Absolutely. But President Trump needs to take a lesson first from Cox and second from Kirk and stop trying to demonize the other side, because that is exactly opposite of what we need at this moment and going forward. And he should, as president, know better. But today was depressing to me because it was another realization that another person killed in acts of political violence that have ravaged both sides. And he has yet to learn that lesson.
Well, I don't know how worried you both are about retribution here. Interesting to see the comment from Jared Moskowitz, the congressman, said people are scared to death in this building. He's referring to the U.S. Capitol, Lisa, where you used to work. Two lawmakers moved outdoor news conferences indoors yesterday. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ruben Gallego rescheduled altogether events they had planned for this weekend on security concerns. Capitol Hill officials are now looking at a review of member security. And there is a chance that senators, in fact, one of the discussions happening right now is that senators get personal security details. That would cost a lot of money, Lisa. And we talked a lot yesterday about what would be involved in making that happen, whether it should. I'm concerned more about the mentality, though, the psychology that's being felt among lawmakers and their staff on Capitol Hill. When you hear Jared Moskowitz say that people are scared to death, what's it going to lead to?
Well, unfortunately, it's going to continue to make it more difficult for great Americans to run for office. Because at a time when we need leaders more than ever before, it's going to make it that much more difficult for folks to stick around because there is a gigantic worry for their own well-being and their own safety. And that, I think, is terrible for democracy.
If they're not safe, they don't feel safe, they're not going to run. Jeannie, how concerned are you about retribution?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm a data person, Joe, so we look at the data and what does it show? It shows, number one, that violence begets violence. So we will, unfortunately, likely see more of this. Another really important thing it shows is that while violence is not yet political violence, I should say, at the levels it was in the 60s and the 70s mostly coming from the left, it is more lethal today. And political violence today is gun violence. That's the other thing that the data shows. So if you want to address political violence, part, not the whole story, but part of that story is addressing the ability of people who would carry it out to access guns. So there's a lot to learn from the data as it pertains to addressing this. And again, it's not just about gun control. We also have to see, in addition to protecting public officials, we have to see some ability to regulate social media and what is happening online. I go back to the fact that these young people today grew up with Charlie Kirk and they watched him die on their feeds and their phones, whether they wanted him to or wanted to see it or not. We have to be able to address this, as well as what we're hearing was the radicalization that may have occurred to the culprit who shot Charlie Kirk. All of those things government can speak to and should speak to immediately. And, you know, Congress is really where that has to start.
Usually after a mass shooting or a major public a tragedy like this, Lisa, there's a conversation, at least for 5 minutes, about gun laws. Jeannie just mentioned social media regulations or restrictions. I'm not hearing anything like that at this point. Are we just too jaded to even go there now?
Well, I think it's a little new and it's a little fresh, and it's the week of 9/11, and there's a lot of other business to be done in Washington. I'm not convinced that there won't be a conversation about that. But unfortunately, it becomes, again, Joe, a battle between right and left and a battle between where can we meet in the middle. And you would hope that this would be an opportunity for us to come together. I mean, we not only had a school shooting the same day, we had lots of violent acts other things that happened. We need to have that conversation.
Well, I appreciate both of your insights very much on this. Lisa Camuso-Miller, our Republican strategist, Jeannie Shanzano, our Democratic analyst, and Bloomberg Politics contributor. Thank you so much both for your candor. Our conversation with Congressman Glenn Ivey, the Democrat from Maryland, is up next, only here on Bloomberg. Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Congressman Glenn Ivey represents Maryland's 4th District, which I can almost see from the roof up here at our bureau in Washington, D.C. It's just across the river. Oxon Hill. If you've ever been to National Harbor, you know where Glenn Ivey does his work. And we've had a chance to talk politics, talk about government funding, and so many issues with the congressman on this program There's more that we want to talk about today, and I want to just give you quickly a little bit of background on this gentleman, because the topics that we're going to get into are very much in his wheelhouse. Glenn Ivey was an assistant U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C. in the late 80s. Washington, D.C., the same city that had federal troops and federal law enforcement walking around for 30 days. He worked for a U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia back then by the name of Eric Holder, who you may have heard of. He also served as counsel for Senator Paul Sarbanes during the Whitewater investigations. And yes, corrupt to coordinate the Senate investigation into the suicide of Vince Foster. I'm not done. Glenn Ivey was also Prince George's County State's attorney. And when he took office in 2002, there was a big conversation, just like we're having right now, about crime statistics. At that time, Prince George's County had the second highest crime rate in the state of Maryland, and his two terms oversaw reductions in crime and led to a number of reforms, measures that included the addition of cameras in police interrogation rooms. He also prosecuted police officers accused of excessive force, and he's with us right now in our Washington Bureau. Congressman Glenn Ivey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I could probably keep going because you've got a really long resume here, but I want to start with what we're talking about here in Washington, and now apparently in the city of Memphis. The deployment of National Guard troops, Memphis is next. You've been around this town for a while. What have you seen work and not work here with the federalization, easy for me to say, of law enforcement in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, the point I've been trying to make, and had been doing this when I was a local prosecutor too, as you pointed out, is, you need long-term partnerships between state, local, and federal law enforcement. The military is not helpful in this front because they're not trained on how to help with civilian law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, they can get in the way and create problems. Yeah. You know, for example, they're not trained in how to do Mirandize suspects or when you're supposed to do it.
Right.
They're not trained in chain of custody or how to collect evidence. Hmm. So you could actually have constitutional scenarios where evidence gets thrown out in very serious cases like rapes and murders. And the excessive force piece is of concern, too. Mm-hmm. So regular civilian law enforcement is trained in how to de-escalate situations, and they've got alternative measures. It's not just go to the gun. They've got pepper spray and tasers and the like. The guys here in D.C. and the way they're deploying them across the country are carrying M4s in some instances, super high powerful assault weapons that can really kill it with accuracy from 800 yards. Wow. And so if you shoot somebody, even if you hit the right guy first, the bullet's going to go through that person. And if you're in a scenario where there's other people around, you could have innocent bystanders get killed, too.
Well, maybe that's why the National Guard troops have spent a lot of time picking up garbage and doing other things around here, running checkpoints and so forth. But D.C.'s one thing.
Yeah.
We're the federal city. The president's got a lot of leeway here.
Right.
What happens when you roll into Memphis and a mayor who says you're not welcome?
Yeah, I think there's an issue there. Chicago and Baltimore have raised concerns, for the reasons that we were just talking about. But I think there are going to be legal challenges if he tries to
Posse
do that.
Posse comitatus.
Yeah, I think that's for sure. So, you know, we'll see how it plays out. Uh-huh. But the bottom line, though, is if he really wanted to try and do things to reduce crime, I think most of these cities would welcome, like, additional FBI agents, DEA, ATF, to help reduce the burdens that they have on local law enforcement, local police.
So use the federal agencies, not the National Guard, is your point.
Yeah, I mean, I used to do that when I was state's attorney. We didn't have the resources. For example, to do a wiretap.
Yeah.
You got a long-term issue like that. Mm-hmm. We'd ask the feds to come in and help, and they had the resources to do it. Sometimes for long-term prosecutions, there's something called RICO, which is a specific federal statute you can use to prosecute federal criminal organizations. We had one where we did it with to bring down MS-13. The local U.S. attorney at that time was Rod Rosenstein, the guy who ended up being Donald Trump's acting attorney general for a time period. But it was a successful joint prosecution. It was nonpartisan. It was effective. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what these cities would like to see from the federal government.
Really interesting. I'll throw another blog on the fire here with regard to your resume. You were also on the commission congressional commission that investigated the attempted assassination of President Trump.
Right.
We're dealing with a heck of a story here. Terrible tragedy with Charlie Kirk, and we have an arrest today.
Right.
The president of the United States announced the death and announced the arrest. The FBI director at one point mistakenly announced that there had been an arrest. What do you make of this whole process so far?
Kash Patel says this was historic, 33 hours, and they've got a guy in cuffs.
I mean, look, I think it's important to not have the political officials get too far out in front of law enforcement, yeah. Especially while the investigation's ongoing. I think the local governor, Cox,
yes.
who is a Republican, was much more restrained and also much more accurate. You know, when Patel came out and announced they had a suspect mm-hmm. they'd arrested and then had to back up because it was an incorrect statement. Mm-hmm. That's kind of embarrassing, but it also undermined the ongoing investigation because people think, oh, they got the suspect. We don't have to keep looking around anymore.
Yes, right.
So, you know, they should just tone that down, let the investigation go forward. I know they've hollowed out a lot of, you know, experienced Department of Justice and FBI mm-hmm. agents. They still have some talent, though, there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Let those folks lead the way. Let the career agents and prosecutors lead this. Step back politically mm-hmm. and let that process go forward.
Well, it's brought about a whole other conversation, and it's probably a much more difficult and complicated one about political violence. And this is something that you spent a lot of time on with President Trump's case. When you consider the other tragic events that we've seen over the past year, the arson attack against Governor Shapiro, the murder, the shooting deaths of two politicians and the wounding of two others in Minnesota,
yeah.
Nancy Pelosi's husband, you were reaching for greater conclusions in that commission, and I wonder your thoughts on this now with new calls again for lawmakers like you to get a security detail.
Well, one of the challenges there was that the Secret Service was already spread too thin.
With regard to Butler.
Yeah. So, you know, with respect to the president uh-huh. and other presidential candidates, mm-hmm. we wanted to focus the resources there, but they also have executive protection when foreign leaders come here to the United States, for example, UN meetings. So there are going to be challenges in giving all of us uh-huh. that level of protection. And even for the president, you know, sure. there can be limits. But look, at the end of the day, I think some of the immediate steps we can take, tone down the rhetoric, let's come together in a bipartisan way. That doesn't mean we stop disagreeing on partisan issues or political issues or policy issues. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't have to sort of try and blame everything on the other guy in a way that inflames people who are at the extremes of the American political spectrum.
Well, we're seeing that already. President Trump said we need to beat the hell out of the radical left. That was a direct quote from the White House driveway yesterday. And he tried to delineate on Fox and Friends this morning between extremism on the right, he said, is just trying to stop crime. Extremism on the left is causing it. You're right in the middle of this, Congressman. Some of your colleagues are rescheduling public events and moving outdoor events inside for this weekend. How are you feeling? Jared Moskowitz said that everyone's scared to death in that building.
Well, there's a lot of concern for sure. And I think people are sort of thinking about, are there additional steps we could take to protect ourselves?
Do you worry about retribution?
Well, you know, I was a former prosecutor, so, you know, who knows, I guess, is the bottom line on that front. And a lot of times these cases, you know, you try and look at the motives behind people who were trying to shoot, like the guy who in Butler who tried to assassinate Mr. Trump. I don't think it's ever been really made clear fully what motivated him. Right. And a lot of these people have mental health issues.
Sure.
And so sometimes, you know, we're not going to get good answers is the bottom line. Wow. I think the key piece, though, is to try and figure out a way, regardless of how you feel about the Second Amendment, there's got to be a way to keep these high-powered weapons out of the hands of people mm-hmm. who have red flags and mental health issues.
Before you leave us, I want to ask you about your plans for Monday to reintroduce the George Floyd and Policing Act. This is the latest in a number of attempts to see action here. Do you have the votes?
Probably not, but, you know, we want to make sure we try and push it forward. Yeah. It's passed the House twice before, and this is a tough era right now, for example, with the Republicans controlling the House, the Senate, and the White House, and pretty much the Supreme Court, too. Yeah. But I think it's important for us to make sure we keep to push, you know, going, and also to make sure that as, you know, the president rolls out these militarized forces mm-hmm. into cities, that we make sure we remind his administration and the country that there's a right way to do policing, that there are limits on, especially for the use of force and the like.
Yeah.
And we need to try and follow those constitutional limits, no matter how you feel about what's going on in a particular town. The Constitution always applies.
Glenn Ivey, great conversation. It's good to see you. The Democrat from Maryland. Congressman, thanks for being with us, as always, on Bloomberg TV and radio.
Thanks for having me.
By all means. We'll keep tabs on that legislation when it's filed on Monday. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.